would you like to create a 10-figure business? Ari Rostagar will tell us how to do this. And what's so special about Ari is Forbes calls Ari Rostagar the Oracle of Austin, and for good reason. He started his career as a law student with just a $3,500 student loan and transformed that into Rostagar Capital, a multi-billion dollar real estate platform spanning dozens of cities and industries, from multifamily and industrial to master planned communities. And along the way, he's become a best-selling author of The Gift of Failure, sharing the lessons of resilience, contrarian thinking, and calculated risk that turned early setbacks into massive success. So Ari, tell us about creating a 10-figure business. How did you start doing that?
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu. Mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
I think very difficultly, not elegantly, not simply, not it wasn't pretty. You know, big things start little. You know, if you look at, you know, people that want to set out to build a wall, as an example, you want to build a big wall. In my experience, if you set out to lay one brick perfectly and you just keep laying one brick, eventually the wall takes care of itself. And I believe that small hinges swing very big doors. So the little work that we do in front of us, or seemingly little, that's directly in our purview, over time compounds into things very big. You know, when I was a law student, I set out to buy this one little lot and build this one house in between classes. And, you know, working on the site, we looked to build it fine. And then over time, through a couple other businesses that failed in entertainment, and thank God they failed. And I wrote a whole book about how they failed and why they failed, thank God. But that transitioned us into the next level, which was doing a fund-to-fund and raising capital from high net worth people and putting them with incredible operators in different asset classes, different parts of the country when I was in New York City. And then doing those kinds of deals, you know, those deals sold and made a lot of people money. They were happy. And then we started to think about owner operating and starting with a little apartment complex, and little by little refining those strategies. Those hinges start to swing pretty doors pretty quickly. So now owning hundreds of acres in the Austin area, investing in over 38 cities, 13 states, 7 different asset classes. We've come to look at property through the vantage point of what it could be, not what it really is on its face. And what I mean by that is zoning and entitlements and the use of land and property has really become our expertise. And that has a lot to do with the law. It has a lot to do with, you know, where cities are going, not necessarily where they are. So I'm talking from Austin, Texas right now. I was born in Austin, and it was a sleepy little hippie town. You know, it's not even a city. It's a town on steroids. And when you look at that town and you look where it's evolved, you have to look at large tracts of land outside the city that were just farms. Well, now those farms could become thousands of houses, apartment units, elementary schools, green spaces, parks, commercial property. And to look at that before it's there and look at the data, look at the AI, look at the population migration trends, you have to go, you know, start to shape what community could be. And that comes to speaking with city council, dealing with other, you know, members of the communities. And that has become the thing that we're most passionate about, is figuring out what these land pieces could become. And then from there, finding strategic alliances to build them, develop them, and, you know, work our way down the assembly line of the different parts that go into building these properties.
Thank you. Tell us what awakened the drive, the motivation to become this massive property titan?
Well, I think hunger. I think deep down, my grandfather was, and my father were Iranian immigrants, you know, that came, you know, a little bit before the revolution, a little bit after the revolution, in the late 70s, early 80s. And I think a lot of Iranians have this very similar story. And to my grandfather, who was a psychiatrist and a medical doctor, and one of the medical doctors for the Shah of Iran, my father went to law school a little bit later on in life. And if you know any Iranians, you'll know that doctor and lawyer are like the only two things your parents make you do, is Now I think maybe engineer also is acceptable, you know, culturally acceptable. And I say that to you to where, you know, my family has studied mostly liberal arts or medicine or law. And I was an English major in undergrad, but to my grandfather as a student of history, a historian, you know, he taught me at a very young age that property is where generational wealth has been created for thousands of years. And as a student of history myself, looking back, there's no asset class historically that has created more billionaires or even risk-adjusted, inflation-adjusted trillionaires than property, you know, over time. And yes, that's changed with technology now and all these different companies maybe, but we'll see where that goes over time. But people make their money in some way and they put it in property. And that dream of my grandfather as an 8-year-old boy driving through, you know, downtown Dallas and him pointing out these big buildings and, you know, wanting to be like, you know, my grandpa and then trying at it and reading the books. And it became something that I could, in my mind as an English major, see that I could maybe envision this property, what could be, how a house could become a home, what these implications are for society that need a place to house and work and play. And being able to see that from a psychological, sociological standpoint, and then watching that transition literally to a blueprint and being something written down, not unlike a dream becoming a goal, and then putting parties together to be able to build it, that canvas, that process became the thing that was infectious for me, was being able to see something that wasn't and imagine what it could be, and then bringing the people to create it. And real estate happened to be that modality. But I look at this through that vantage point, though. I love the architecture. I love the design. I love the color schematics. I love in our larger, you know, 300-400 acre sites of looking at a farmland and figuring out where the elementary school could go, where the parks could go, you know, what streets would look like, the distance between the houses and apartments and where people would walk to go eat and where their, you know, local, you know, grocery stores are. And then looking at that from a high level, because first we can shape, you know, a city or shape a community, and then those communities shape us. And that process, that evolution, that storytelling is the part that me, myself, I'm most interested in.
Thank you. So would you say that you were motivated mostly by the mission of helping millions of people to get great accommodation and live in great environments? Or would you say that also you were motivated by the idea of becoming, I don't know, a billionaire? And which would you say was the main driver?
Well, look, when you're, you know, I'm a regular guy. There's nothing special about me. You know, I was garage sailing with my mom as a young kid, you know, delivering pizzas through college. You know, I had a very bad speech impediment growing up, so I had to go to 7 years of speech therapy just to learn how to talk. Wasn't a great student, you know, until I got to college and law school, I figured it out. But I tell you all of that to where I wish I could tell you of some grandiose philanthropic need to go do all this great stuff, which it became. But at the beginning, I just wanted to make friends. I wanted to be seen. I wanted to do something interesting. I wanted to feel like my life was worth something, and I wanted to be rich, you know, at the beginning. And then having that drive, and I know it's not, you know, people don't say that anymore, but that was really what it is. Then over time, when you start to contribute and you start to, you know, you want to make yourself money, that's one thing. But when you, that's very limited when you want to do something for you. And there was a moment where I realized when it started to be investor capital, holy shit, if I make all these people money and I get a piece of it, the expansion of what that could be so much bigger. And they asked Rockefeller one time, and I'm a nerd. All I do is reading is my life, from Chekhov to Dostoevsky to Dickens to Shakespeare to, I'm a reader. It's in my DNA, it's my education. But they asked Rockefeller, you know, how did you become a billionaire? And his answer stuck with me forever. And I think about it often, especially in the investment management business, because, you know, I'm not in the fee business, I'm in the performance business. So the more we perform, the more we make money for our investors, the more money that we make. And that's how it's designed. And he said, you know, how did you become a billionaire? And he said, I made 1,000 people millionaires. And that moment was when everything shifted from I to we. And then I started to look at this from a different vantage point of saying, oh, all these people together, if I make them money, if I build this house that can become a home, if I can create this thing, where then my focus became about being obsessed over my customers, being obsessed about my end users, obsessed with my investors, and somehow automatically it shifted into something bigger than me. And incidentally, when that happened, the business started to grow geometrically.
Thank you. Why would you say most property investors don't become millionaires?
I think that they're too impatient because a life and real estate happens in decades, not in days. And people think with the, you know, and I'm just my one guy's opinion, but the TikTokification and the Amazon Prime has changed our return expectation of how quickly we need gratification. So the wealthiest people in the world historically can delay gratification. They can wait for that result for a long period of time until they get the dopamine hit. Property is the same. So if you look at typical private equity funds, they're 7 to 9 years. Usually 7 years is the minimum. And then there's 2 1-year extensions, maybe three. Meaning the investment by design is illiquid for almost 10 years. Well, that tells you the smartest real estate people in the world need 7 to 10 years to create an outsized return. Imagine what amateurs are trying to do. And I tell you that to where I feel very fortunate and blessed that I've been able to sit without results, you know, for much longer, I think, than some of my peers. You know, I was very much a late bloomer. So it was okay for me to look at a 10-year plan, a 20-year plan, a 50-year plan, a 100-year plan. And so when we looked at properties, we looked at land, we looked at deals, we thought we want to buy things that we could own forever. You know, do you sell them? And do we end up selling and make money? Absolutely. You know, thank God, not every deal made money, and that's life. But the point is, my timeline and my horizon, I believe, is significantly longer for how long I'm willing to wait. And compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. You know, compound interest and compound debt is where time makes you extraordinary returns. If you look at a 7% return over 3 years, it's not very interesting. A 7% compounded over 50 years is fucking insane. And so this same mentality of letting time do the heavy lifting, not me, I think is what's differentiated our strategy and how we look at things, is having a patience to let time do the heavy lifting is where this is transformed from something, you know, with, you know, one comma to two commas and now three. And hopefully if we do our job right over the next 20 years, it'll be four.
Thank you. I'm really amazing at attracting extraordinary, visionary multimillionaires like you to me. And I find that I recently realized, actually, that I'm really bad at closing multimillion dollar deals. And if only I could sort this one out, I could be, you know, in a very different place in my life very, very quickly. And I'm wondering about what would you say makes the difference between, first of all,
I'm going to tell you a story.
Yeah.
Okay. Respectfully, I'm going to cut you off. I'm going to tell you a story. Because what you just said reminds me of something that I learned from someone at the time, much, much smarter than me, much wiser than me. I was in New York City, and I felt very self-conscious that I didn't have an MBA. Okay, because again, as a liberal arts person, I'm going into business, I'm in New York City, my boss is one of the most decorated financiers in Wall Street history, literally, $450 billion in deals. Think about that, $450 billion. Okay, and this was 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And so I started to take night school at NYU and to study for like a business thing. And it wasn't directly an MBA yet, but I thought if I take some courses, free courses, I learn some business things, maybe I'll go get an MBA, and that was my goal. And one day he found out kind of that I was doing this because I was a little extra tired. And he said, you want an MBA? And I said, yeah. He said, hire one. He said, you want two MBAs? Hire two MBAs. And I tell you that to where one of the biggest failures of my life is early on thinking that I needed to be good at my weaknesses. that I needed to know how to close, in your words, in your band, a multi-million dollar deal. With your platform, your skills, your extraordinary nature of you bringing people together, your charisma, all these skills that you have, my humble advice would be to go find some closer to work on your team, to be honored to work around you, and let them do the paperwork and you do the stuff that's intangible and be in your genius and let somebody else be in their genius. That's called a team. That's called scalability. That's how you go from thousands to millions to billions.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was going to reach to, which was that I had this breakthrough myself a few days ago. And I realized, actually, I know so many closers that are closing hundreds of millions of dollars kind of deals. And, you know, they're really great at that. And I'm really great at this. So like together, we can be like a superpower team. And I'm wondering about for those people that actually don't have the kind of skills that you and I have, that perhaps are really struggle to get in front of the right people, of the right extraordinary, visionary, multimillionaire entrepreneurs like you, and that also struggle to close the multimillion dollar deals. What would you say to those?
No, I think that you have to educate yourself. You know, I'm a very curious person. And the only thing that I know for sure at this point in my life is that I'm going to change my mind and I'm going to learn something new and something's going to evolve. And the people that can't get in the door or say things, I think that they have a mental block, you know, that's not necessarily they can't get in the door. There's just another educational gap piece. There's some potential energy that hasn't been activated. For me, I do a massive amount of inward work. I do a profound amount of meditation work, profound amount of self-development work, profound amount of work with Tony Robbins and Dr. Joe Dispenza and these different people that have helped me on my journey to overcome these barriers or these things that I thought were issues, where in a world of LinkedIn, in a world of Instagram, a world of groups, to not be able to get in the right door is a bad story. That's just not the truth. The truth is there's some other psychological barrier. There's some other thing, some lack of education or knowledge or wisdom that is gapping that, because there is access to everybody. There's free lists. There's so many things out there to get you in the door. But at this point in this society, in my opinion, getting in the door isn't the magic. You can get in the door. The knowledge is what's going to keep you in the room. And that's the part that we can spend our time doing when the stakes are lower.
Thank you. Tell us about creating a 10-figure business. Where would someone start from? I don't know. Let's say someone is already making $1 million. How would they get to 10 figures? What's the 10 commandments of the must-have elements you would have to put in place to get there?
Well, I'm not an expert in this. I'm sure people much more seasoned and much smarter than me can give you a better roadmap. But what I can tell you, one thing that I believe to be mandatory is your ability to delegate duties and your ability to build systems and have people build systems that are repeatable, that they can begin to be automated. Because one person or a person can only do so much. They can only work a certain amount of hours. They have to sleep, they have to eat, they have to go to the, you know, they have to do all these different, they have family, they have all these other things. But a system or a process or a software or something that can be done continuously, that is what allows scalability. So if you're at a place where you're already, you know, a seven-figure earner, clearly you're a leader, clearly you're very capable, clearly you're very significant, clearly, you know, you've done great things in, you know, in your life, certainly the ones that are completely self-made, and, you know, and the other ones too, you know, the other ones too. It's still a great feat to do it repeatable. But the only thing that I think initially would be lacking is how you interact with team, how you interact with process. So if you're going to really go in, start spending the time to educate yourself on how to build a system, how to build something where you are no longer doing the work as much. The system is, the processes are people in your organization, developing an organizational chart to be able to scale you and your abilities. Because until they learn how to clone me, which I'm sure they'll figure out, there's only so many places you yourself can be at one time. And that's the bottleneck to the growth of the business.
Thank you. And how did you make your first $1 million?
I made my first $1 million when I was running an entertainment company. I wrote about it in my book, and we were doing these huge parties around the Super Bowl. This is the 15-year anniversary of that business failing, thank God. And the first line of my book is, I hope you fail. I hope you fail a lot. And I really mean that, because that's failing is how you learn how to win. And in this instance, we signed the halftime show of the Super Bowl. It would have been Bad Bunny effectively this year. It was the Black Eyed Peas. It was David Guetta. You know, we've got the biggest corporate sponsors in the world, Sports Illustrated, at the time MySpace, I'm aging myself. And then the biggest ice storm in the history of Dallas crushed the parties, crushed the profitability. So I went to sleep with millions of dollars in an account as a startup business in my 20s. And by the next morning, it had disappeared. So I fell asleep a millionaire and woke up broke.
Thank you. Tell us about your personal skills. What would you say got you some unexpected results? Like, do you ever find that having great hair helps to kind of like close deals? Like, or having like a great sense of humor, or like wearing a certain vest, like being memorable in some way? Because for me, I find that it helps to be memorable.
Yeah, I can tell you something that my tailor, who passed away recently, his name was Martin Greenfield. He's probably the most famous American tailor in history. He wrote a book called Tailor Made Man, and he got famous by he was an Auschwitz survivor, and he was there when Eisenhower came. And throughout his life, he you know, a family adopted him. The man was a tailor. He learned how to be a tailor, and his dream one day was to thank General Eisenhower, then President Eisenhower, with a suit. So he got the opportunity, he told everybody, you know, now his kids and grandkids are my friends. And, you know, and that was his dream, to tell him thank you. And he ended up being able to make Eisenhower a suit. And he liked it so much that Martin made every suit for every president up until Donald Trump, by the way. So he is the tailor to the president. And one time I was talking with him, you know, about some suits, we were looking at some different things. And he said to me something that I'll never forget. And there's a few conversations, but one in particular is, your style should be understated elegance. And I asked him, I was like, well, look, I want to stand out. I want to be memorable. He said, exactly. You want them to remember you, not your suit. And so ever since then, I veered away from pinstripes. I veered away from some of the things that are a little bit more ostentatious, because people would remember the suit. And I wanted them to remember me based upon his advice.
That's very interesting. Tell us about some of the most out-of-the-box things that you did in order to close deals.
Health and wellness, you know, because at the end of the day, you have to have energy to work at this level, to work 120 hours a week for 20 years at a time, and take no days off, which I've done most of my life. And you have to have energy, you know, and if you feel like shit, you can't do it physically, and you're limited at some point to what your physical output is. So I decided to make my body and my blood work an investment strategy, to where about 10 years ago, I started to manage my nutrition the way that I would manage a property, you know, and make sure that cholesterol levels, how I ate, food sensitivity tests, hormone replacement, hyperbaric chambers, and do a place where I could take, I'm 43 years old. I feel better than I've ever felt in my entire life by leaps and bounds, like not even close. I think at 25, I looked 45. And that particular piece, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great American thinker, said health is wealth. And I know it sounds a little corny, and you know, say, oh, health is wealth, people roll their eyes. But in reality, if you don't have your health, you don't have shit. And that is your true most important asset. So I invested early in my life, in my early 30s, aggressively into managing every aspect of my mental health, meaning, you know, the meditation practice that I do, which is part of my life, posture management, mobility, strength training, nutrition, and constantly optimizing it with nutraceuticals, so that my body, I could feel good in my skin. And at the end of the day, people do business with people they like. That's just the end of the thing. So when you come in and you have a vibrancy to your energy, literally a true vibrancy, and people that are healthier, they vibrate at a higher frequency. We can measure that now. That's not esoterics, that's not mysticism. You know, that's not, you know, you look at a cancer cell, the way that it vibrates versus a very healthy cell, it puts off a different energy. We all know people like this. When they walk in, they're glowing, they feel good, they look good, they're dancing, they're happy, they're joyous. And I invested in that part of me. So whenever I show up, I can show up in my best self. I can give more, I can contribute more, I can feel better. And that has been one of the intangibles that has been a great focus of my life.
Thank you. What are some other out-of-the-box elements that you implemented in your negotiation, in your communication, in the way that you show up in front of these kind of investors that perhaps are willing or interested to put tens of millions of dollars into your projects? And
what
did you need to do? And what did you need to do so that you don't come across needy and desperate and kind of come across relatively calm, despite the fact that, you know, every single deal could potentially change your life, you know, with leaps and bounds? Yeah.
Well, I tell my team this all the time, and, you know, and I feel like I did some of this a little bit naturally. And looking back, I think it's become a strategy. As I always tell my guys when they're and ladies that are, you know, in the sales side of the business, are either raising capital or finding deals, negotiating with brokers, finding debt brokers, you have to build relationships. Okay. This business, certainly the investment business, real estate, I can't speak for other businesses, but real estate is a relationship business. Who has the deals? Who has the debt? Who are the banks? Who are your investors? So I've always said, we don't make sales, we make friends. And literally, and so how would you treat a business opportunity if you legitimately were trying to make a friend? Not bullshit. Then that's the whole secret, is there's not a secret. Like, if I talk to you right now and I start asking about your family, where are you from? What kind of food do you like? Where, you know, how do you get your hair done? Where did you buy that shirt? Tell me about yourself. What makes you laugh? What makes you smile? And then I remember that, and we talk about it, and we see each other over 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 instances. You will inevitably say, I like that guy. He knows about me. He asked about me. He knows my birthday. He knows my anniversary. He knows where about what town I was born in. He looked up my whatever. And so I've always taken the approach of, with the people that I know to be significant, or I hope to be significant, is if I make a friend, inevitably we'll do business.
Thank you. What did you do in order to attract more business to you? As in, like, to have, rather than like you chasing and you pushing and you kind of like,
you always are pushing. You're always pushing. I'm at the early season. I started my business 11 years ago. I'm the founder and CEO on 100% of my business. My business is in fifth grade. And there's, at that point, you are always going out and getting business. I don't know about other, maybe other people, business just shows up on their door, but I'm of the belief that you go out and get it, you know, and that's doing everything, showing, speaking at conferences, messaging people on LinkedIn, watching videos, being on podcasts like this, putting yourself in a situation where people know you and you know them, and constantly cultivating new relationships, not just referrals, which is so transactional, but truly getting to know the people you're in business with, then invest with you, get to know their friends, and chances are the person you're in business with is other people like you they're in business with. Same with me, introducing your people to their people and creating a community that is around something that is mutually prosperous, that is truly authentic. And the more that you do that, the more that you put yourself out there, the more that you make proactive messages, whether on Instagram or LinkedIn, there's so many resources. There's gazillions of resources that didn't exist when I started. I was cold calling financial advisors before there was a CRM. I was just looking up people in Google and say, oh, they're a financial officer. And I would call 200-300 people a day. I got 50 million on one cold call, which actually changed, you know, the trajectory of my career. But you have to go out there and go do it. In my experience, like I said, maybe people smarter and more capable than me don't have to, but for us, we are constantly on offense, constantly meeting, constantly talking, and putting ourselves out there to be in a situation where people see us, where we can add value, they can add value for us, and we can create some symbiosis.
Thank you. What's the best way to not be written off? What I mean by that is, to be taken seriously. Let's say you make a cold call or you meet people at events. What's the best way?
Call again.
So you actually,
Well, here's the thing. If you look at the old psychology of advertising, for somebody to make a decision, it takes about to see you or your brand 13 times. Okay. This was the old thing 20 years ago, 13 times, 7 to 13 interactions. Maybe it's an email, maybe it's a call, whatever. Well, now the amount of things and distractions that people have, there's a new study that says it's 33 interactions for them to say. So most people quit at 2. They make one phone, didn't work. I called 3 times. I followed up 4 times. And then they wonder why, but it needs to be 30. And so you need to set the benchmark so much higher, and you don't want to be a creep, But if it's really something that's that interesting, find out where they go. Follow them on LinkedIn, like their LinkedIn post, follow them on Instagram, find a post, send them an email, send them a card in the mail, call them on the phone, get to know the friend of their friend in their network, you know, and build yourself into the fabric so they come to know you as the authentic person that you are, the service that you're offering. But it takes a profound more amount of work. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, think it comes easy. You know, I don't know. I don't. None of this is easy. But the repetition and the amount of work that goes into it, you know, people miss opportunity because opportunity shows up in work clothes. And that's just reality.
Thank you. Tell us about how did you close this $50 million deal? And what did it take to do it?
Yeah, it's, I mean, a lot of it is very confidential for, you know, whatever, but it's exactly that. I was making 200-300 calls every single day for months with all rejections. And one of the guys I ended up talking to became my client 7 years later. One of the guys that was on there that remembered, by the way, remembers, like, who's this kid calling me on the phone? And then after Forbes and after all these other things happened, remembered, and we became friends. So it took a lot of time. One of the guys was a junior person that knew somebody that introduced me to his boss, and his boss introduced me to his boss, his boss introduced me to his boss, and that turned into $50 million. So it wasn't a, you know, just a, you got to work through the process and all along. And I know all those people to this day, the junior guy that introduced me to the guy and then went to the guy, four people. That first person on the cold call is still my friend to this day. I texted him 2 days ago, 12 years later.
How does someone become mentally tough and emotionally tough in a way that they
suffer
can with rejection?
Suffer. Do it. Suffer. That's the only way. Suffering and pain are the only way to get tough. If you don't suffer, and you know that as an athlete, you know, any athlete or anybody that goes to the gym knows that you gain 90% of the gains on the last rep when your arms are shaking. This is the same psychologically and physically. You have to suffer, and you have to put yourself in extremely uncomfortable situations over and over and over and over and over and over again until you're comfortable being uncomfortable.
Thank you. How do you overcome the fear of failure or the fear of showing up again in front of people that you have failed?
I'm not an expert, Lily. I know anybody that is experimenting with those, the depth of the questions you're asking, which are beautiful questions. And I think they're the right questions, by the way. I'm just not a psychiatrist in that regard. And I think there are professionals that can. But I can tell you, for me, a lot of my work in seminars has been very helpful. Like, I've gone to all these Tony Robbins seminars over the years that he deals with a lot of these issues in a 7-day seminar for 12 hours a day, uncovering these issues. And, you know, but for me, they were very difficult, and it's taken a lifetime to think about them. And I don't think I've overcome them. I don't think I've mastered them. I think that it's a journey and I'm on them, but I think you're asking the right questions, and people that are asking those questions, there are solutions out there. And experts and coaches and people that can really give you the kind of help. And I just recommend, ask for help, you know, and that's what I had to do. And I find that it'd be very fruitful if you ask the right people for help.
Thank you. How did you become a great negotiator so you can close these deals that are of hundreds of millions of dollars?
I don't know if I'm a great negotiator, actually. I'm not entirely sure. You know, I find that in law, when you're training to be a litigator, to be a trial lawyer, which I was for many years, one of my old professors used to say, a good lawyer can argue for his client, right? A great lawyer can argue for his opponent. And I think that when you're in a real negotiation, doing a deal in good faith, if you really understand and put yourselves in the shoes of the other party and understand what their needs are, it's not always money. It might be speed of close. It might be some keeping their name on the building. There's so many intangibles, but listening and really understanding the objective of the person on the other side of the table and to really find what their need is not always what you think their need is. What you think their need is not always what their need is. But the more that you dialogue, the more that you look into it, the more that you listen, you can find what the real need is. And when you find the real need, they understand your real need. And I think a deal happens.
Thank you. What are the best questions that you can ask your potential investors so that they become interested and attracted to the kind of deals you want them to invest in?
Ask about them. I ask about them. I spend most of the time talking about them, not me, and understanding their background, understanding what their goals are, understanding, you know, where they want to be, what do they want to do with this investment. And all the a lot of times I'm not a good fit. And the more that I talk about them, because real estate investing is not like a stock, you know, you're in it for years. It's like a marriage. You know, so you have to really understand that you both have, you know, the same goal, the same objective. And so I spend a lot of time trying to understand their needs. How do I fit in their bucket? What does their portfolio look like? You know, where are they in their retirement age? If it's a person, you know, meet their spouse, meet their financial advisor, meet their CPA, and just really dig into what their needs are. Because as my client, they're the hero of the story, not me. And when I take me out of the equation and get to know them first, not only do you come with a lot of trust and you earn a client, a raving fan for life, you also find out quickly if it's not the right client or if it is it is the right client. But I find in my business, knowing very quickly if it's the wrong fit sometimes is much more profitable than closing it quickly or this, that, and the other and finding out it's the wrong one. Just like any of us who are divorced, know marrying the wrong person can be much more fucked up than waiting.
Thank you. How do you discover the best investing opportunities? Because we all know that sometimes, let's say you have a really amazing relationship with one person, but you mess them up one time, but not out of the fault of your own, but sure, perhaps something happens and then they lose money because of you. Then it's kind of unlikely they will invest with you again. Or if they do a lot more due diligence, or they will, I don't know, they will take a lot more time to think about it. So like what do you do so that you find the best possible investment opportunities to reduce the risk of failure and to reduce the risk of losing money for them?
Look, investing is not, there's nothing guaranteed about investing, you know, and adults that invest. And this is the reason why, like in the States, you have what's called an accredited investor. They have to have a certain amount of net worth. They have a certain amount of income, certain amount of sophistication. Certainly the pension plans, you know, anybody that tells you that an investment is guaranteed, you should run. Okay. Unless it's a U.S. Treasury, which is considered to be a risk-free investment. I'm not so sure about that anymore, but it's called a risk-free investment. And I say that to where, you know, focusing on all of the downside risk potentials early on and figuring out what's called asymmetric risk investing of, you know, how can you protect your downside while maximizing your upside? And what does that look like? Or calling it a hedge or finding non-correlated investments. This has to do with due diligence. This has to do with how you make your disclosures. It has to do with a whole slew of factors. But the most important thing in that process is not only transparency with yourself, because a lot of times you look at a deal, I'm guilty of this, and you get emotional about it. You like it. You want to do it. You know, this is what investment committees are for, you know, to where people can spot red flags. Oh, we looked at this. You look at that, or you get too close to a deal, and making sure that you're making decisions based on mathematics, not based on your feelings. And you do that by surrounding yourself with people with differing views, with differing skill sets, different levels of due diligence. And when things go wrong, I find ripping the Band-Aid off and communicating is the most important thing. Communicating with the people, you communicate the best you can. But if you're a professional investor and you've involved in hundreds of millions or billions of dollars a year deals, you've lost money, or else you're not real. You know, and the ones that appear that haven't or try to act like they do, I find the smartest investors I've worked with and the biggest investors, they're interested to see, how did you do when COVID happened? How did you do when interest rates spiked? And a lot of times finding a deal that just broke even, you know, when everybody else was down 50%, to real investors is a big win, you know. Or how did you, you know, deal with some unexpected occurrence when interest rates hiked 500 basis points, you know, in a very quick period of time? But this is when you find out who has done their homework on the most important rule of investing, which is don't lose money. And, you know, and you can't always do that. But if that's your goal, amateurs think about how much money they can make. Professionals, in my experiments, think about all the different ways that they can lose. And if you try to mitigate that and you focus on that predominantly, the probability of making money increases exponentially.
Thank you. Tell us about some exciting investing projects you have right now.
A lot. Like, we're doing some incredible things in Austin. Like, we have this beautiful master plan community. We donate 11 acres to the city of Kyle, which is just south of Austin and north of San Antonio, to build the new elementary school. And it's been one of the most fulfilling things in my life to see that school open on the land that we own, seeing children there and, you know, in the land that we bought that was just a farm and building 60 acres of green space and how that will impact the 1,000 houses in this project, 1,400 apartments, huge commercial space. And, you know, that's just one of, you know, dozens of properties, obviously, but that one's very exciting because we're going to start to 3D print and use robotics and 3D printing and AI to develop some of the houses that we're going to build for rent. And to be able to do that diligence on these technologies and see how close it is and how feasible it is and done right, the cost basis is just absolutely incredible. And I'm very passionate about the data centers that we're building and we're working on. You know, getting the right power, dealing with, you know, the water facilities, working with the cities to build these incredible, huge facilities for AI chip manufacturing and other types of cloud services and, other large language models. It's just an incredible new world that that is very, very exciting for a variety of reasons.
Thank you. Tell us about the minimum that an investor might need to put down in order to get involved with one of your investing projects at the moment.
Sure. So if you're an individual investor, we have a very large book of just accredited investors, you know, which means you make, you know, over have $1 million net worth, not including your house, 250 grand a year, you know, there's a guidelines. So our minimum is probably $100,000 now. Which is for a lot of people is, you know, is very accessible. And you know, we have hundreds and hundreds of investors like that. The bulk of our money is institutional, is family offices, insurance companies, public pension plans, firefighters. And then what we've tried, large investment companies in New York. And, you know, we pair our smaller investors with our larger investors, which is something we're really proud of because a lot of smaller investors, they don't get to participate in, you know, 600,000 square foot industrial facilities. But if they can, we can pool that capital together, a bunch of 200,000, 500,000, 100 together and make it 5 million. I'm just using a number. They can invest along an institution that has 40 million and then do, you know, be a part of a deal. That's very exciting. And, you know, if and knock on wood, if we do our job right, can also make a lot of money. And and so that's absolutely, there's some incredible opportunities and things we're very proud of.
Thank you. Tell us where investors can connect with you.
Sure. You can go to rastigarcapital.com or to rastigarinvest.com, either one of them, and learn about some of the active deals. We're very active on all the public platforms, social media platforms, LinkedIn, Instagram, at Rastigar. Property and, you know, a simple good or bad, a simple Google search of my name will tell you more than you ever wanted to know. And reach out. And what I'm proud about is, you know, when you reach out to us, you have a real human that'll call you. You know, your call will be answered, you know, by a real person. They'll talk with you. And if they can help you, they'll tell you. And if they can't, they'll also tell you that too. You know, real estate, as I said, is not for everybody in certain timelines. Some people have unrealistic expectations, but those that are patient enough to let, you know, time do something, it can be the largest wealth creator of anything in the world, certainly over the past thousands of, and we can track this down to the Babylonian era of real estate investing and what that means. And, you know, we're just getting started. You know, I'm a 43-year-old CEO. I started this business, you said, from a, you know, very small amount of money. To me, it was a lot of money at the time. And we're just getting warmed up, you know, and we have this incredible pipeline, incredible deal flow, incredible time, and there'll be a lot of opportunity.
Thank you.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.